They were at the height of their careers. Then they disappeared.
Was he shot, stabbed? Was he thrown off the bridge?
A highly regarded Harvard professor goes missing in Memphis shortly after September 11th.
It was a major loss to science. It was a major loss to the world.
Did his work with the world's deadliest viruses make him a target for biological terrorists? And later, a man who worked on Hitler's deadliest weapon.
It had a warhead which could basically flatten a city block.
Walks out of his office, never to return.
It was just a mystery.
Now, after 50 years, new information points to an unlikely assassin.
The Israelis needed somebody inside.
From Memphis to Munich, men who knew too much and vanished without a trace.
You can think as much as you want that you're safe, but you're not.
Memphis, Tennessee, November 16th, 2001. A mystery unfolds on the iconic Hernando de Soto Bridge that spans the Mississippi River.
A trucker radioed the Memphis Police Department dispatcher advising that a vehicle was parked on the side of the interstate on Interstate 40 on the bridge.
It's just 2 months since 9/11. The country is still on edge, with deadly anthrax mailings claiming five lives. It's feared another terror attack is imminent, with major structures like bridges and landmarks as possible targets. For Detective Robert Shemwell and the Memphis PD, these are tense times.
Heightened alert throughout the country that somebody might try to take out the bridge. To park a vehicle in the middle of the interstate, that's suspicious in nature alone. But during this time in 2001, right after 9/11, it was really, really suspicious.
At 3:47 a.m., officers approach the vehicle. The car is unlocked. Keys are in the ignition. The engine's off, but the car's in perfect working order with a full tank of gas. The driver has simply vanished into the night.
The obvious is that he parked his vehicle, got out and jumped off the bridge, committed suicide. But a lot of times the obvious answer is not the correct answer.
The car is a rental, and police are able to quickly identify the driver.
When we began to find out who was leasing this vehicle was when the name Don Wiley came up.
Police soon realize Don Wiley is no run-of-the-mill missing person.
And what we did was to shine X-rays on crystals of a protein from the surface of a human cell.
He's a world-renowned scientist, a Harvard professor specializing in lethal infectious diseases.
Dr. Wiley's work really focused on understanding their structure and how they invade the human body and how the immune system fights against them.
Dr. Don Wiley's groundbreaking research had redefined science's understanding of how infectious diseases spread.
Don was a structural biologist, which meant that he studied biology in three dimensions.
You're creating a three-dimensional shape for these tiny, tiny little molecules, and it allows us to really understand them. Because if you think about it, how do we understand the function of something if we don't know its structure?
Don was highly acclaimed scientist. He had won many prizes. The Japan Prize, which is a huge scientific prize. Lasker Award, which 50% of the people who win that award win the Nobel Prize. He was in the National Academy of Sciences. He was a Howard Hughes investigator. He was a world-renowned scientist.
For police, in the wake of 9/11, Wiley's scientific expertise is a red flag.
This is not just your average Joe. This is a very important individual.
Investigators can't rule out the possibility that Dr. Wiley's disappearance is the work of terrorists.
Certainly it's feasible for terrorists to want to get their hands on a guy like Don Wiley.
The reason? His specialized knowledge of infectious diseases could potentially create the perfect terror weapon.
Terrorists find biological weapons interesting for the same reason generals find them terrifying, because they spread out of control. They have a certain biblical indiscriminate effect. For military operations, that's nightmarish. For a terrorist trying to cause, well, terror, that's just fine.
Don Wiley is an expert on disease transmission. He's mapped the molecular structure of killer viruses like Ebola, HIV, and influenza.
His work was really seminal in that it taught us why some of these diseases were more virulent, more impacting.
It's unsettling to think that some of the same techniques could be used by terrorists to make biological weapons like we've never seen before.
The possibility of bioterrorism is made more frightening by the anthrax mailings that coincide with Wiley's disappearance.
People were terrified. They had no idea if a follow-on assault was going to come. It was an extremely scary thing.
With such turmoil in the country, authorities can't help but suspect Wiley has been abducted.
The theory at the time of Dr. Wiley's disappearance, especially because it was right after the 2001 anthrax attacks, was that he was potentially kidnapped and forced to build a biological weapon.
Is this something new? I mean, the airplanes into the building were new. Is this something new that is now going to occur to our scientists?
With no sign of Wiley or his body, 5 days after his disappearance, this is no longer just a matter for local law enforcement.
When someone like that goes missing, the FBI would be intimately interested in the circumstances surrounding his disappearance.
FBI contacted me. At first, it was, if you need us, call us. Several days later, it was, we're going to assign someone, and we're fixing to open the case up.
But there are no leads, no clues, no way to even tell if this was a crime.
There was no witnesses, no crime scene. There was no direction really to go into. As an investigator, you want to go back and start from the last location that you know that someone actually saw him.
Dr. Wiley was in Memphis for a meeting of the Scientific Advisory Board at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. On the night he disappears, he attends an official dinner for delegates at the Peabody Hotel. Among them, Wiley's close friend and fellow scientist, Dr. William Evans.
That night was very pleasant, very relaxed. People were enjoying sort of being done with a very hard day's work at the institution.
According to Dr. Evans, Wiley's behavior is completely normal.
He was in the conversation, driving the conversation, really, which was typical, Don Wiley.
With family nearby, Dr. Wiley isn't staying at the hotel.
He almost always stayed with his father, who lives in the suburbs of Memphis, and he was doing that evening. And I left probably around 11 o'clock. The group sort of began to disband, and I said goodbye to Don in the lobby of the Peabody.
When the colleagues left, he returned back to the bar, and he struck up a conversation with several of the locals.
He was an effusive personality. He loved to have a conversation about anything. It could range from science to the opera to, you know, a baseball game. He was that kind of individual.
Bar staff say Wiley left just after midnight, heading for valet parking. And that's where the trail goes cold.
No one observed where he went. No one observed his vehicle pull off, so we were back to square one.
4 hours after he left the hotel, Wiley's car is found on the Hernando de Soto Bridge. The fact is, he should never have even been on the bridge. The Peabody Hotel is in midtown Memphis. Dr. Wiley's father's house is east of town in the suburb of Raleigh. Yet his car is found on the bridge heading west, on the way out of state.
Why was he going westbound on Interstate 40 when he should have been going northbound on Interstate 240 towards his father's house?
It's not the way he would go to the suburbs of Memphis. If you're on the bridge going the direction that car was going, you're going to Arkansas or beyond.
Inspection of the car reveals a few anomalies. It's been damaged in a minor accident with scrapings of yellow paint.
It looked like he might have just bumped a gate. But we noticed that there was undercarriage damage on the driver's side, and there's also a front tire hubcap was missing, as if he might have jumped a curb.
No corresponding damage is found on the bridge, and there's no sign of the missing hubcap. The investigation is raising more questions than answers.
When we were coming up with dead ends,
investigators have little choice but to fear that Dr. Wiley's disappearance is part of a new era of biological terrorism, a prospect that looms even larger when it's discovered Wiley holds the secrets of the deadliest virus the world has ever known.
Probably the biggest infectious disease threat that the human race ever faced, and a cataclysmic event, almost like an extinction event.
In November 2001, a mystery is unfolding in Memphis. Harvard microbiology professor Don Wiley has disappeared. He was last seen leaving the Peabody Hotel around midnight on November 15th. With no leads and no witnesses, investigators return to the only physical evidence they have: Wiley's rental car, found abandoned on the bridge.
The obvious is he got out of the car and jumped.
But the people who know him best, like good friend William Evans, don't believe Don Wiley would ever take his own life.
There was no reason Don would contemplate that. I mean, I was with him the night before. He was perfectly normal. I knew his career. He was doing great as a scientist. He was receiving awards. He had a wonderful family.
In fact, on the day after he disappears, Wiley's wife and two young children are on their way to Memphis to spend the weekend with him.
He was supposed to go pick the wife and the kids up from the airport himself.
I had the unfortunate task of being the one to go to the airport to tell her what we knew at the time, which was that Don was missing.
It's hard to believe that Don Wiley would contemplate suicide the night before his wife and family were traveling in for a family get-together.
But investigators have already pursued every available lead.
Is this person having an illicit affair outside his marriage? Is he doing something that's running him up into debt that he can't cover? You could have an angry husband coming after him. You could have someone he owes a lot of money to. But none of that seemed to have occurred in Don Wiley's life.
So where's Dr. Don Wiley?
Investigators return to Don Wiley's scientific research, and the possibility it's made him the target of biological terrorists.
Scientific discovery is often the result of the combined efforts of many talented individuals, something like the music produced by an orchestra.
Specifically, his work on influenza.
Influenza is particularly concerning as a biological weapon because it's constantly changing. It's already pretty transmissible, and there's many different kinds of it.
Many people think of influenza as just some very simple minor infection that they get every year, but influenza is probably one of the biggest infectious disease threats the human race faces.
Through his molecular mapping, Wiley was the first to reveal precisely how the influenza virus attaches to human cells, then constantly mutates into even deadlier strains.
The influenza virus changes every year, which is why we have to get another flu shot every year. And so Don's science would inform what the flu shot should look like every year.
But recently, Dr. Wiley has been working on the most deadly influenza strain of all, a virus that 100 years ago swept across the globe, killing whole families in a matter of days, decimating entire towns, and briefly bringing humanity to its knees.
The 1918 influenza outbreak was probably the biggest infectious disease threat that the human race ever faced, and a cataclysmic event, almost like an extinction event.
Known as the Spanish flu, it's the largest epidemic in history, killing up to 100 million people, 5% of the world's population.
It went around the world, killing millions of people, and we had never seen anything like that.
In 1997, scientists in Alaska unearthed the Spanish flu from victims who died 80 years earlier.
They exhumed bodies that were buried in the permafrost. People were then able to recreate the 1918 influenza virus and unlock its mysteries.
Dr. Wiley helps map the resurrected killer virus for the first time and identifies the mutations that made it fatal to 20% of those it infected.
Influenza's genetic structure is best thought of almost like a deck of cards, and that card deck can shuffle, and you come out with a totally new influenza virus because it's able to exchange and recombine and shuffle its genes.
If terrorists could engineer those genetic mutations in a laboratory to maximize the spread of a deadly flu strain, they could achieve mass murder on a scale the world has never seen.
Infectious diseases have the ability to change society and create massive chaos and lead to downfalls of government. All of the structures and infrastructures of that society could collapse.
Which is why Don Wiley's mysterious disappearance raises alarms.
There was a lot of concern that potentially someone who had worked with the 1918 pandemic had gotten kidnapped by some bioterrorist group and was going to be building a biological weapon.
This very well might have been an abduction or murder.
Today, about 3:15, we were notified by the Federal Bureau of Investigation office in New Orleans that a male white had been found in the river.
December 20th, 2001. A body is found more than 300 miles downstream from Memphis.
The identification on the body was that of Dr. Don Wiley.
The river flows south towards the Gulf of Mexico. His body was in the river a little over a month.
Finally, authorities know that Don Wiley is dead. But they still don't know if he committed suicide or if his scientific knowledge led him to be murdered. Wiley's corpse may hold the answers.
Was he shot, stabbed, thrown in the water? Did he fall off the bridge? Was he thrown off the bridge? Was there a struggle before that? A lot of those questions are going to be answered by the coroner.
The autopsy shows that Wiley's body has sustained extensive injuries.
On this diagram that was done at the time of autopsy, and you can see that there are rib fractures on both sides, the right and the left.
And he had a crushed chest, he had fractures to his skull, his sinus cavities, his spine was broke.
All told, Wiley has over 40 broken bones. It's an injury pattern consistent with falling the 109 feet from the bridge to the water below.
When a body falls from great height to water, hitting the water is basically the equivalent of hitting the hard ground. They die from their blunt impact injuries before they can drown.
None of these injuries immediately indicate abduction or murder.
There was no defensive wounds to his hands, no gunshot wounds, no stab wounds. Everything was consistent with a fall.
And still, nothing to indicate Dr. Wiley's whereabouts in the crucial four-hour window between leaving the hotel and the discovery of his car on the bridge.
It's not really 4 hours. It's 4 hours and a month. We know he left the valet heading for his car. We know he was found in the river 350 miles downstream. Everything else in between, we don't know.
Not a single witness ever saw Dr. Wiley on the bridge that night.
My gut instinct in this case tells me Don was never in that car on that bridge.
Could he have been intercepted in the parking lot of the hotel or run off the road as he left?
He may have never left that hotel in that car. That car could have been driven on that bridge by somebody else. That's why it was found in the wrong direction, because they didn't know what direction his dad lived in. They drove it to the wrong bridge or the wrong way out of town and left it there.
It's possible that the car was staged there, but I think that he definitely still had to have fallen from a great height to cause that magnitude of injuries. So I don't think those injuries would have resulted from, for example, being beaten.
They could have been holding him for weeks, interrogating him on his skills and his knowledge with respect to biological weapons, knowing that they would use the river to dump his body eventually.
If Dr. Wiley had jumped or had been pushed off the bridge, he would have the same injuries. But in a shocking twist, the coroner rules out both likely options. In a highly specific and unusually detailed finding, he concludes Wiley's death was a freak accident.
The theory the initial medical examiner had about Don Wiley's death is that he was driving over the bridge, he got out of his car because he had gotten in some type of accident, he was disoriented, he got near the edge of the bridge, and then a truck went by on high speeds, creating some type of backdraft wind. And this pushed him over the edge of the railing because his center of gravity was higher than that of the railing, like this.
Wind and vibrations allegedly sent Wiley tumbling over the guardrail.
As an investigator, I was really kind of shocked.
The coroner's theory leaves many perplexed.
It doesn't seem to me that a moving truck on the far side of the bridge would generate enough wind and vibration to knock a full-grown man off that bridge.
While this is a very elegant theory, it's probably more specific than I would feel comfortable going as a medical examiner if this was my case.
The theory regarding how Dr. Wiley fell off the bridge, to me, just didn't add up. There's no way the trucks could have vibrated that bridge enough to cause a 6'3" man to fall over a 43.5-inch concrete barrier to go off the side of the bridge and land in the water. We're also there in the left lane. His vehicle is blocking the right lane, which is the side that the rail that he would have gone over on.
Any wind gust generated by a truck would have at least 15 feet to dissipate before it hit Don Wiley.
Dr. Wiley's brother was at my desk, and he was extremely mad. He stated that he came to find out how his brother died, and he had to listen to that bullshit. And that's the way he put it.
But following the coroner's report, the case is officially closed. Many mysteries remain. And despite the findings, Shemwell is reluctant to rule out foul play.
To say that Dr. Wiley jumped off the bridge, fell off the bridge, or was pushed off the bridge is still an unanswered question.
I don't think we'll ever know what happened to Dr. Wiley. There's a lot of mystery surrounding his death.
Whether he was the victim of an abduction or a tragic accident, the threat of biological terrorism didn't die with Don Wiley.
In the future, as biology gets more advanced, as more and more people have access to sophisticated biological science, as the computers and DNA sequencing devices become easier to obtain, cheaper, more common, it's possible that some terrorist could start making something awful in his bathtub.
Stay underground.
For family, friends, and colleagues he left behind, Don Wiley's disappearance remains a baffling mystery.
We scratch our head and we wonder to this day exactly what happened. A brilliant guy. I mean, it was a major loss to science. It was a major loss to the world to lose a guy like Don Wiley. He just had great momentum and he had enormous talent and he was an intellect that's sort of rare to encounter on this planet.
It's not known if Wiley's work played a role in his death. But 40 years earlier, in West Germany, a very different scientist goes missing. And this time, the reason is clear. September 13th, 1962. An abandoned car is found outside Munich. It's registered to 49-year-old Dr. Heinz Krug. He's been missing for 2 days.
The police find his car abandoned and covered in dust, you know, a few miles outside of Munich.
The car was in the middle of nowhere. Krug must have driven there and then left the car. There was nothing nearby except for a forest.
In a report about his disappearance, Dr. Krug is named in a secret U.S. State Department cable as a Munich-based businessman running a company called Intratrading. There's a reason U.S. intelligence is keeping tabs on Krug. 20 years earlier, Krug is a Nazi missile engineer, part of the team who built rockets for the Third Reich at Pina Mundi on the Baltic coast. He holds deadly knowledge that will soon be linked to his disappearance. In 1962, a missing German engineer, Dr. Heinz Krug, is discovered to have a dark past, helping to build Nazi Germany's most devastating weapon.
Heinz Krug worked for the V2 program, which was Hitler's attempt to produce a rocket that could hit Great Britain.
When Hitler had his best scientists working on developing rockets, Heinz Krug was with them as an acquisitions specialist. Krug was able to get whatever parts the scientists needed in order to build rockets.
Designed by Wernher von Braun, the V-2 was a monumental 46 feet long, towering over all rockets built at that time.
Churchill's science advisor claimed that a rocket of that size could not be built and that it was all a hoax. And then, of course, in the late summer of 1944, these things come screaming out of the sky and blowing up in the streets of London.
With a range of 200 miles, V-2 rockets are launched from Holland, killing 7,000 British civilians and servicemen in the last year of World War II.
It had a warhead of about 2,000 pounds, about a ton of high explosive, which could basically flatten a city block. From a technological standpoint, it was a game changer.
After the war, Wernher von Braun and his fellow rocket scientists are in high demand. Von Braun surrenders to America and is wooed by U.S. presidents, from Harry Truman to John F. Kennedy. He and other German scientists will work on ballistic missiles and go on to build the Saturn V, the rocket that put man on the moon.
German rocket scientists had proven themselves to be among the best in the world.
Initially, Dr. Heinz Krug remains in Germany. But in the late 1950s, he too is invited to America.
Von Braun said to Krug, "You could be useful to us here in the United States. Why don't you come here?"
Krug turns down the offer and instead begins working on a strategic missile program for Egyptian President Abdul Nasser, who has his sights set on a key American ally, Israel.
Krug really wasn't comfortable with the thought of working for Americans. They'd been the enemy during the war. But working for Egypt, trying to come up with plans that could hurt the Jewish state of Israel, that appealed to Krug. And apparently the money was better in Egypt, too.
The Egyptians were so determined to acquire this capability that they basically say the sky's the limit in terms of finances. Whatever you need, we'll provide. Please give us this capability.
By 1959, American intelligence dossiers report dozens of German scientists are working at a top-secret missile facility rising from the dust outside Cairo.
They actually set up a factory, Factory 333.
From the very beginnings, it was clear that everything had to be imported.
A lot of those materials were not available on the open market.
And that's where Heinz Krug comes in.
The Egyptian rocket program couldn't succeed without someone who would get the parts that it needed. Heinz Krug was a genius at it.
Recently, declassified archives reveal the central part Krug played in the Egyptian rocket program.
Krug's role was to be the middleman, the person who procured equipment and materials for the project.
His intra-trading company in Munich is purely a front for his covert shipments.
Intra was created by Heinz Krug specifically so he could get the components that the German scientists and their Egyptian factory needed.
Basically, the scientists gave Krug their wish list. This is what we need in order to produce this weapon, and it would be up to Krug to go out and find it.
Western intelligence agencies try to monitor Factory 333, but can't penetrate security.
What went on behind the walls in 333 was a bit of a mystery. What are the Egyptians up to?
All becomes clearer in July 1962, when President Nasser proudly and publicly test launches his homegrown missiles, named Al-Zafir, the Victor, and Al-Kahir, the Conqueror.
Suddenly in 1962, the Egyptians show the world that not only do they have ballistic missiles, but as Gamal Abdel Nasser said, we made them ourselves.
In reality, they couldn't have done it without the German scientists. For neighboring Israel, it's a worst-case scenario. Arab missiles built by ex-Nazis, right on their doorstep.
And in a press conference after the launching, some journalists said, so what are the range of these missiles? And Nasser said, anywhere south of Beirut, which of course would be the entirety of Israel.
The German scientists might even be motivated by what Hitler had wanted to do. They failed to destroy all the Jewish people during the war, and now the Germans were trying a second Holocaust? This was honestly the fear of the Mossad director, Isser Harel.
Israel's secret service, Mossad, launches a campaign targeting the German scientists working for the Egyptian rocket program.
Harel felt that he had to get them all to quit the Egyptian program. He felt intimidation was the best way to do that. That he'd also have to kill at least one or two of them. That would send a clear message. He considered these Nazis to be enemies of the Jewish people, so he certainly didn't hesitate in ordering assassinations.
According to former Mossad agent Viktor Ostrovsky, because of his vital supply role, Dr. Heinz Krug would be a prime target.
If he would have agreed to leave, he would take the whole program with him. The head of the snake is taken care of, and the rest of the body will die.
In 1962, former Nazi rocket engineer Dr. Heinz Krug disappears. He's last seen at his Munich business office, intra-trading.
He got a telephone call for a meeting with someone.
By all appearances, these people knew each other. They get into Heinz Krug's car. They're supposedly going out to lunch.
Krug is never seen again. His body is never found, and his disappearance remains a cold case for 50 years.
It was just a mystery what had happened to this German who definitely was working with other Germans for Egypt.
But after spending years sifting through secret archives and interviewing anonymous sources, investigative reporter Dan Raviv now believes he knows what happened. The trail leads to Israel's secret service, Mossad.
The Mossad was able to make Heinz Krug vanish without a trace.
That finding is backed up by deep research carried out on the ground in Israel by renowned security and intelligence journalist Yossi Melman.
I can't reveal my sources, but I believe that it was a Mossad operation which eventually resulted in the disappearing of Krug.
The fact that people didn't know what happened to Krug until lately is because Mossad is really not in the business of advertising what they did.
The alleged Mossad mission Raviv and Melman uncovered was a complicated operation. In the summer of 1962, Krug is unknowingly under Mossad surveillance, part of their campaign to stop Egypt's rocket program, codenamed Operation Damocles.
Damocles representing a threatening sword hanging over someone's head, and that's certainly what the Mossad wanted to be when it came to the German scientists.
Well, Israel's attitude towards the program was very simple. The Egyptians cannot have missiles. The weakest point that the Mossad decided was actually the scientists themselves. If you can scare them enough, they'll leave.
When threats and intimidation have no effect, Mossad raises the stakes with letter bombs.
One bomb explodes and kills five Egyptians at a mail sorting facility. Another bomb explodes and blinds the secretary of one of the scientists working in Egypt.
Heinz Krug realizes his life is in danger.
He didn't want to give in. He liked working with the same German team that he'd been with in the 1940s. So he wasn't going to quit, despite the intimidation.
But Krug decides he does need protection. He turns to another former Nazi insider, a decorated guerrilla commander, the notorious Otto Skorzeny.
Otto Skorzeny was Hitler's favorite commando. Otto Skorzeny was very tall. He had a scar on the left side of his face. He was sometimes referred to as Scarface Skorzeny. He was a commando who rescued Mussolini in one very famous rescue operation when Hitler sent Skorzeny in, and he basically glided onto the top of a mountain, rescued Mussolini to great acclaim.
The Nazis called him the most dangerous man in Europe.
Heinz Krug believes if anyone can keep the German scientists safe, it's Otto Skorzeny. Not only does he share their Nazi background, Skorzeny's CIA file reveals that since the war, he's helped train Egypt's special forces. When the two men make contact, Skorzeny is living comfortably in Spain.
Skorzeny was able to live in Madrid and became a security consultant, making a lot of money as a lot of governments hired him for his advice.
Krug turned to him to request that he help protect the German scientists in Egypt and create some sort of a protection field.
With the battle-hardened Skorzeny by his side, Dr. Krug believes he'll have the best security money can buy.
It would make absolute sense for Krug to feel comfortable in hiring somebody who's also a Nazi and a very well-known Nazi. He would be less worried about being betrayed or sold out.
The two men arrange to meet and are last seen driving away in Krug's car.
You can think as much as you want that you're safe, but you're not.
On September 11th, 1962, it's believed Dr. Heinz Krug leaves his office in Munich with Nazi war hero Otto Skorzeny in the car. They're meeting to discuss a protection plan for the German scientists working on Egypt's rocket program. Or so Dr. Krug thinks.
Otto Skorzeny was actually recruited by Israeli intelligence, Mossad.
Incredibly, Israeli Secret Service had allegedly managed to turn a Nazi into a secret agent for the Jewish state. An almost unbelievable coup revealed after years of research by Israeli intelligence reporter Yossi Melman.
To approach Skorzeny was a very speculative, risky, but also clever approach.
Mossad's initial attempts to intimidate the German scientists haven't stopped the rocket program. They realize they need to step up the campaign.
In order to do this, the Israelis needed somebody inside.
Someone who would be trusted by other Germans.
It would be in the Mossad's advantage to recruit a Nazi, to hunt a Nazi.
Months earlier, Mossad sends agents posing as a German couple to Madrid, where Skorzeny has been living.
Skorzeny was deeply suspicious and said, "I know who you are, and I know why you've come. You've come to kill me."
Skorzeny's biggest fear is that he is on the same Israeli hit list of Nazi war criminals as the infamous Adolf Eichmann.
If you're Otto Skorzeny, you know darn well what happened to Adolf Eichmann. They found him living under an alias in a country in South America, thousands of miles away. And not only did they find him, they abducted him, stuck him on a plane, and flew him back to Israel to put him on trial.
Eichmann is found guilty of crimes against humanity and executed on June 1st, 1962. Skorzeny fears he will be next.
He said, "I know that I'm on a list of wanted Nazi war criminals, and that Israel might be trying to kill me. I want you to remove me from that list.
The agents assure Skorzeny they can make that happen, sealing one of the most unlikely deals in the history of espionage.
In fact, the Israelis were not able to move Skorzeny's name from the list, but the Mossad fooled Skorzeny.
And they forged a letter to Skorzeny saying that Skorzeny was no longer on the list of wanted Nazis.
But it's believed Skorzeny fulfills his side of the bargain by traveling to Munich to meet Heinz Krug. As they drive deeper into the Bavarian forest, they're trailed by a second car. Skorzeny tells Krug the three men inside are bodyguards.
They ended up being Israeli agents.
Krug is told to pull over and get out of the car.
Then Otto Skorzeny shot him and killed him.
Mossad agents allegedly dispose of his body by dousing it in acid.
It sounds gruesome, but the remains then become, well, just a pile basically of liquid muck. And the Israelis would dig a shallow hole, the muck was gone, and the person had vanished.
Mossad's goal is to sabotage Egypt's missile program and send a terrifying warning to the German scientists who work on it. Liquidating former Nazi Heinz Krug achieves both.
In the Mossad archives, the agency is proud of what it did in Egypt. Nasser was not able to develop the rockets that he had dreamed about.
The program didn't just slow down the Egyptian missile program, it eliminated it. It stopped it completely.
A year later, there was no single German scientist in Egypt. The ultimate goal was to stop German scientists helping Nasser, and that was achieved.